Welcome to Jonathan on Money, the personal finance podcast that brings you the latest insights and strategies to help you achieve your financial goals. I'm your host, Jonathan I. Shankman. On this podcast, we'll cover everything from investing, financial planning, retirement, and behavioral finance. I'll share advice and practical tips to help you make the most of your money. So whether you're just starting out or looking to take your finances to the next level, Jonathan on Money is here to help. Let's dive into this week's show. Welcome to this episode of Jonathan on Money. This is episode number 54, and this should drop right after Passover, which means summer is rapidly approaching. And summer means better weather in New York, and I always feel a spark of joy in my life when the weather improves. So I'm very much looking forward to that. Just a quick reminder, I share daily financial planning videos on my YouTube channel. The name of the channel is Jonathan on Money, so be sure to subscribe so you can view that content. The videos are only 2 to 3 minutes long and are generally on something quite timely, so be sure to check that out. That's Jonathan on Money on YouTube. So my talking points this week will discuss some important lessons we learned from the late, great Daniel Kahneman, who passed away March 27th at the age of 90. I mentioned in a previous episode a little bit about him, and I'll discuss a little more in depth about his contribution to the world of personal finance, in which he had a lasting impact. We're also going to discuss an important quote from legendary investor Peter Lynch. And as always, I'll spend the last half of the episode answering listener questions. Well, with that, let's jump into this week's talking points. So on March 27th, we lost Daniel Kahneman, a giant in the world of personal finance. And Kahneman was not a financier, tax advisor, or estate planning attorney. He was a trained psychologist. And a fun fact for some listeners, he was the nephew of Rabbi Yosef Shlomo Kahneman, the former head of the Panovich Yeshiva. Yet his impact on the world of wealth management was vast. He was a pioneer in the field of behavioral economics and was awarded the 2002 Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences, shared with Vernon L. Smith for his work in this area. In short, behavioral economics is the study of psychology as it relates to the economic decision-making processes. It explores why people oftentimes make irrational decisions and why human behavior does not follow the predictions of economic models. In my own practice, I find myself discussing the implications of behavioral economics for investing far more than most other topics. After all, the biggest stumbling block for many investors is themselves. The tendency for people to get in their own way is usually what prevents folks from achieving success in the markets. And I'm going to share a short list of examples of the intersection of psychology and investing where Kahneman made contributions. Each of these cognitive biases, as they're known, comes up regularly in my conversations with clients. So the first is anchoring and adjusting. An individual's decisions are influenced by a reference point or an anchor, which can be completely irrelevant. Anchoring can be used to advantage in sales and price negotiations, where setting an initial anchor can influence subsequent negotiations in your favor. However, it can cause erroneous results when the initial anchor deviates from the true value. For example, if your friend in school told you that a certain stock is worth no more than $20, that can become your anchor for its value. If it is now trading at $30, you may be reluctant to buy the stock, even if it's a sensible addition to your portfolio. You may also assume that if it drops by $10, it is a good buy because you are anchored to that $20 price point. Meanwhile, your friend's assumptions and analysis, or lack thereof, may not be based on anything other than his uninformed opinion. Yet you now will make decisions based on the price he mentioned. Another is what is called the availability heuristic. This is a type of cognitive bias that helps us make fast but sometimes incorrect assessments. It involves relying on information that comes to mind quickly or is most readily available to us. For example, an investor may impulsively invest in a real estate project because they saw a news story about how the returns for real estate have been excellent over the past few years. However, making an investment decision based on recent news headlines without conducting a thorough analysis is ill-advised. It leads to impulsive investment decisions based on readily available but potentially biased information. Next is base rate fallacy. This is also known as base rate neglect and is a cognitive error of prioritizing a particular set of data over the general information of a larger collection of data, also known as the base rate. This results in an error in judgment. For instance, if an investor has two investment opportunities, one investment has excellent recent returns, but is incredibly risky and has a long history of eroding investors' wealth. The second investment has had lackluster recent performance, but over the long term provides more consistent returns with a lower probability of losses. Investors may be more likely to choose the first riskier option that has experienced better returns as of late. This may be done if they are not given sufficient information about their historical performance. This is a tactic used by promoters or marketers of certain investments where they'll highlight excellent returns over the past year or two while conveniently neglecting to mention historical returns in that asset class. This could lead to devastating outcomes for investors. Another is loss aversion. This is a phenomenon where a real or potential loss is perceived by individuals as psychologically or emotionally more severe than an equivalent gain. For example, the pain of losing $100 is far greater than the joy of in finding the same amount of money. This is something that comes up often when working with an individual who has massive gains in their portfolio. They may have gained hundreds of thousands of dollars in their account, yet a relatively small drop in value can throw them into an anxious tizzy or even cause them to sell their investments and abandon their strategy. There's something called optimism bias. This is a tendency to overestimate the likelihood of positive events and underestimate the likelihood of negative events. Optimism bias causes most people to expect that things will work out positively, even if rationality suggests that problems are inevitable. I've seen this bias present itself in two ways. The first is when clients insist on concentrating in a certain area of the market. Some people have told me that real estate only goes up or tech stocks are the future. Why invest anywhere else? The truth is, no investment or area of the market is impervious to a downturn. This is why it's essential to maintain a diversified portfolio regardless of how much you believe in any one particular investment. The second area is insurance planning. While it's good to be optimistic about investing in life, bad things do happen. Death, disability, and long-term care issues face all families. This is why buying insurance to protect against these unavoidable circumstances is essential to any plan. While it's good to be optimistic, it's even more important to be realistic in your strategy. And finally, there's the status quo bias. This is the tendency for people to stay with what's familiar and comfortable rather than change and take risks. In the context of investing, this can be dangerous, at least to missed opportunities or staying on a path that will lead to financial challenges down the road. I see this bias come up frequently with clients on the cusp of retirement. They have accumulated accounts at various firms, old employers, and an assortment of other random investments. The default position is to leave things where they are. They often search for excuses to maintain the status quo, citing good returns, which usually isn't true, a nice employee of the bank, which is not relevant, or the perceived advantage of having money spread across many institutions. There isn't one. For many investors, overcoming that urge to do nothing by cleaning up and consolidating their investments is an essential step to having financial peace of mind in retirement. And I'm fond of reminding my clients, indecision is still a decision, and it's usually the wrong one. There's a myriad of other biases that impact our personal finances. It's worth discussing this topic with your financial advisor, as well as the best ways to overcome them. Too often, the focus of a financial strategy is on finding the investment with the highest possible return, mitigating taxes, and lowering fees. In reality, spending more time on controlling your behavior and refining our process around money can make us all more successful investors. Understanding Professor Kahneman's groundbreaking work in this field is an essential first step to any sound investment strategy. And as they say, may his neshama have an aliyah. Okay, those are the talking points this week. And as a reminder, you can be notified of all my recent articles, webinars, and all the work I put out by subscribing to my free monthly newsletter at parkbridgewealth.com/newsletter. We're currently at 8,500 subscribers and growing, so feel free to sign up and invite friends as well. Now for this week's money quote, which is from the legendary investor, Peter Lynch. For those who don't know, Peter Lynch was the manager of the Magellan Fund at Fidelity between 1977 to 1990, where he averaged 29.2% annualized returns. This consistently more than doubled S&P 500, making it the best performing mutual fund in the world at that time. During his 13-year tenure, assets under management increased from $18 million to $14 billion. And Lynch once said, "Far more money has been lost by investors preparing for corrections or trying to anticipate corrections than has been lost in corrections themselves." And by corrections, he's referring to a correction in the stock market where it drops a significant amount. Lynch's point is that so many investors or would-be investors are nervous and hiding cash due to the next market correction and end up missing out on the growth in the market during all that time, worrying and waiting for that anticipated market correction to materialize. I've seen this in my own practice where prospective clients want to invest and know that they haven't want that they should invest their money, yet they're so concerned about the market dropping that they never end up doing anything. I had a conversation with one gentleman years back who had $9 million sitting in cash for 15 years. In the time he spent worrying, he could have easily doubled his money, but he was so traumatized by the great financial crisis that he just spent his time preparing for the next one, and it cost him quite a bit of money, likely more than any money he would have ever lose in a regular market downturn. Remember, if you suffer from this irrational fear, it's worth trying to automate your investment strategy and outsourcing to a financial advisor so you can make prudent decisions and not let fear control your life. Okay, now let's jump into this week's financial questions. And if you do have a question, feel free to submit it to me at jonathan@parkbridgewealth.com, and it may be answered in a future episode. Okay, first question. I'm in my mid-50s and I have nothing saved for retirement. Literally nothing. The good news is I do have a relatively high income, and I'm waking up to the fact that I need to get my act together and I'm willing to do what it takes. What would you suggest to someone in my situation? The answer is you need to save a tremendous amount of money from now until you retire. The questions are how much money and what type of accounts. In terms of how much money, I can't answer this because I know nothing about you or your personal spending habits. However, if you can aim to save half of your income every year to make up for lost time, I imagine that would be a good start. In terms of where to save these funds, you should obviously max out your 401k and profit sharing plan if possible. That may be able to get you to $69,000 in savings a year, depending on your circumstances. If you have your own business, you have a bit more say on how your retirement plan is run, so you can definitely put away the $69,000 limit in this regard per year. You can also set up a cash balance plan, which may allow you to put away hundreds of thousands of dollars a year on a tax advantage basis. These plans cost money to set up, and you should be willing to spend money on setting it up correctly. Getting a specialist involved is imperative. The corporate retirement plan arena is not the area for do-it-yourself type of people. There are too many areas where you can mess things up. The final thing I would say is you will need to be pretty aggressive with your investment allocation for the next decade or so in order to make up for lost time. And you should implement an aggressive allocation to adequately make up for lost time. And as you mentioned, the good news is you make good money. So there's a pathway to success, and not everyone is so lucky. It's now up to you to make it happen. Next question, thoughts on ESG investing. ESG, environmental, social, and governance investing, is really just a marketing ploy used by asset management firms to attract more assets by promoting the latest fad. ESG investing was all the rage over the past decade. I've seen socially conscious investors flock to companies and mutual fund strategies that marketed themselves as adhering to positive environmental, social, and governance principles. However, over the past few years, some investors have raised questions about this strategy, the methodology used, and whether it best reflects their intentions. Instead of ESG, I've been introducing clients who are disenchanted with traditional ESG strategies to explore a values-based approach to investing. This more personal strategy allows investors to curate portfolios using their own methodology for allocating funds that accurately reflects their own worldviews and personal creeds. Thankfully, with markets ever-expanding menu of investment products and a focus on holistic wealth planning, this type of values-based customization is far more seamless to implement than I expected. Over the past year, I've helped individual investors explore their values or express their values, I should say, through their portfolios in the following ways. One, excluding exposure to countries that have a history of poor human rights. Two, investing in regions of the world that promote democracy and Western values. Three, adhering to religious values. This has been mostly with Muslim clientele, trying to avoid haram or forbidden goods and services. Four, preserving multi-generational family values. And five, voicing disapproval through stock ownership. These points not only allow investors to make an impact, but also increase the likelihood they will stick with their long-term investing goals. Staying the course during market gyrations and letting compounding work its magic is the ultimate way to build wealth and achieve a client's financial objectives. And by the way, a few weeks ago, I was on a panel that discussed ESG investing through ETF.com. If you'd like to hear that panel discussion, feel free to email me and I'll send you the recording. Next question, what financial advice would you give to someone in their 40s? Some Top financial considerations for families in their 40s or the parents are in their 40s include one, get your legal documents in place. By this point, you probably have assets and a family, and both need to be planned for in case you die. Two, review beneficiaries. Along the same lines as the previous point, you likely have assets, so be sure they go to the intended people if you die. So many people don't do this and funds pass to the wrong people. Easy fix to what can be a big irreversible problem. Three, increase your savings rate. You're likely entering your peak earning years, so make sure your saving rate goes up. It's quite tempting to want to spend more money as you make more money, but you need to try to minimize your lifestyle creep. More money means being more responsible with where you allocate your funds, and you should be sure to take care of your future self by saving more money as you earn more. And four, don't chase after nonsense, or in my world, don't chase after nourishkeit, as we call it. More money and more discretionary cash available means more money to blow on stupid things, such as luxury cars you don't need, a vacation house you will rarely go to, stupid investments discussed by your friends and brother-in-law. Focus on spending money on smart things and smart investments. I can rant about this all day, but you get the picture. Naturally, there are other points I would suggest to a 40-year-old depending on their specific situation, but this is enough to whet your appetite. Next question. My CPA always insists that I make backdoor Roth IRA contributions. He's quick to point out the benefits, but are there any reasons for me to not do this? So every decision is in personal finance and life has trade-offs. Since you already know the benefits to the backdoor Roth IRA contributions, here are some items to be mindful of. One, the pro rata rule. If you have funds in an IRA account or a SEP IRA and then make backdoor Roth IRA contributions, there will be tax consequences. This means you need to have all your retirement funds within a corporate retirement plan to avoid these adverse tax consequences. These plans may be more restrictive with their investment options. It also means you can't use IRA which may also be appealing from a consolidation perspective to keep all your old retirement accounts in one place where you do all your own investing. And two, you lose optionality. I like investing funds in a taxable account because I'm not restricted as to when I can take out the funds like a tax advantage account. Most people don't talk about this and get focused on future taxes. I personally don't do backdoor Roth IRA contributions and contribute to my business retirement accounts. And if I have extra cash flow, I invest into my taxable account. I don't let a very minor tax perk drive my investment decisions. And this may seem like heresy to the CPAs listening to this, and that's fine. The key is viewing your entire financial picture more holistically. Oftentimes, this means foregoing the option to make a backdoor Roth IRA contribution. It's really not such a big deal either way. Next question. I made 15% annually investing in private credit. I don't understand why my portfolio at a big financial services firm has performed so much worse. I'm trying to give the folks there the benefit of the doubt, but I see no reason why I shouldn't just pile all into private credit. The mistake you're making is comparing an entire portfolio investments at the financial services firm to a single investment. Every year, different investments are in favor and others will suck royally. A well-designed portfolio will usually have many different investments and there will always be winners and losers. This is a way to manage risk. If you look under the hood, my guess is you have exposure to investments that have outperformed your private credit investments, such as the total U.S. stock market, S&P 500. While your private credit investments have allegedly done well over the past few years, you can also get wiped out completely. That won't happen with an entire portfolio of investments. Risk and return are inextricably linked. Proper investing necessitates managing your risk, hitting singles and doubles, avoiding getting struck out, and you will build a substantial amount of wealth over time. However, if you pile into extremely risky investments that have performed well recently, you may be riding high. Unfortunately, the good times don't go on forever, and you will likely lose most of your money if you are concentrated in this strategy. Very few people can gamble for a long time and not lose their money. Next question. Given the earthquake in New York recently, should I get earthquake insurance? So this question makes me feel like someone from your kiddish club at shul is trying to sell you earthquake insurance. It must be the next hot thing now that SPACs and NFTs fizzled out. Anyway, if you're residing in New York, that seems unnecessary. It happens pretty infrequently, and when it does happen, they're generally pretty schwach earthquakes. However, the earthquake should wake everyone up, to the fact that some things are an act of God and are totally out of your control. This includes unexpected death, disability, long-term care needs, home and car accidents, etc. Thankfully, there's insurance for all these items, and you should absolutely have coverage. You should also have an umbrella policy. It's always prudent to plan for the unexpected, assuming there's a realistic chance of it occurring, unlike a massive earthquake in New York. Next question, is the money I made in March Madness pool taxable? So this sounds like a question for a CPA, but here's my inexpert opinion. Yes, you should recognize that there are tax implications associated with winnings. Essentially, any money earned from gambling is taxable income. Depending on your tax bracket, you may be required to pay ranging from 10% to 37% of your winnings. Additionally, certain states may impose additional taxes on gambling winnings, typically ranging from 3 to 10%. Most gambling websites provide a W-2G form for winnings exceeding over $600. It's still prudent to keep your own detailed records of all gambling transactions, including winnings, below this threshold to ensure accurate reporting. As a general rule, don't be cute with taxes. Pay them and move on with life. The alternative is steep penalties or ending up in Otisville. Neither are attractive options. Next question, what financial advice would you give to someone in their 50s? Here are some ideas to chew on. One, consolidate your investment accounts as much as possible. One of the biggest challenges for folks approaching retirement is having a mess of a financial situation. Here's a newsflash. Having 401ks at multiple old employers, multiple investment accounts at various financial institutions, and several checking accounts is not a plan. It's a mess and it should be cleaned up. It will only become more difficult to do this as you get older. Two, your investment should be structured to reflect your rapidly approaching retirement. You are no longer able to take devastating market losses, and you should position your portfolio accordingly. Three, your 50s and 60s are typically people's max earning years. Make sure you're socking away a lot of money for retirement. And four, consider long-term care planning. This may mean self-funding, buying insurance, or Medicaid planning. It's good to start exploring options at this point to adequately prepare for your future. And the next question is, with inflation rising again, what should I be changing with my investment strategy? So you should never change your investment strategy based on a recent headline. In financial technical jargon, we call this a rookie move. Your portfolio should be set up with inflation in mind. So if you're younger and have a multi-decade time horizon until you need those funds, it means you should have a lot of stock exposure, which will outpace inflation. If you are older with a shorter time horizon, you should have bonds and cash paying around 5% that it currently is, which is outpacing inflation at the moment. If you're somewhere in the middle, I imagine you have a strategy designed to achieve your goals and can withstand some elevated inflation numbers. Don't get excited anytime an unfavorable news headline comes out. If you have a strategy in place, the best move is usually to stop reading the news, smoke a J, enjoy the day, and do absolutely nothing. Next question, actually final question for this episode. It seems like most financial professionals spend a lot of their day watching CNBC or Bloomberg. Is that a good way to stay informed on how to manage my finances? No, this will not help you at all as an investor. These networks have a fiduciary obligation to their shareholders to create more ad revenues. Bloomberg's a privately held company, but they also have stakeholders. And the more ad revenue they get by attracting more eyeballs is the most important thing for them. They attract more eyeballs by blowing everything out of proportion to keep you watching. If these networks gave accurate financial information, it would say, stay the course and ignore the noise. But they are the noise. They are the distractions, and they are trying to keep you on edge of your seats by breaking the latest stories. In reality, there is not a noteworthy story every hour, day, week, month, or even year. I stopped watching these networks and will only skim the headlines on their websites every day. I found that they are good at being on top of the latest news stories, even though they are usually not important to my clients' portfolios. Now that I think about it, it's interesting that every major financial institution has a gigantic TV with CNBC or Bloomberg playing. I even had one in my office when I worked for a large firm. Like many things in corporate America, it's a lot of smoke and mirrors, but no real reason for it. Hundreds of TVs, fancy offices, a butler service, which I actually had at one of my previous firms, layers and layers of managers, and mandatory training about DEI and sexual harassment that no one actually listens to. The clients are paying for all these extras. In reality, the only financial content you should be consuming is the Jonathan on Money podcast and social media posts. It really doesn't get any better than that, if I do say so myself. Okay, that's it for financial questions this week. Again, feel free to email me with any questions you have, and I might answer them in a future episode. And you can reach me at jonathan@parkbridgewealth.com. Additionally, if you can take a minute to subscribe to this podcast and rate it, this show on Apple or Spotify, it will help other personal finance enthusiasts find the show as well. And with that, it's a wrap for this week's show. Any comments or questions, feel free to reach out directly to me via email. I love hearing from my listeners. And finally, the secret to financial success is no secret at all. It's to spend less than you make, invest the difference prudently, and ignore all the noise. See you next time on Jonathan on Money. Thank you for joining me on today's episode. I hope you were able to take away a nugget or two to apply to your own life. Make sure to subscribe to this podcast so you can be alerted whenever new episodes drop. If you'd like to submit a question that may be answered in a future show, please email me at jonathan@parkbridgewealth.com. Be sure to check out all Jonathan on Money content, including all of my articles, webinars, and videos by following me at Jonathan on Money on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Finally, if you like what you heard today, please rate the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This helps ensure that other personal finance enthusiasts can find the show as well. Thank you, and catch you on the next episode of Jonathan on Money.